The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. It's estimated that 20% of Americans suffer from some form of anxiety at any given time. Keep in mind that there's a wide continuum of anxiety, from the kind of stress we might label as productive, the kind that helps us get work done, all the way to an extreme form, like panic disorder, which can be crippling because of its intrusiveness in our lives and the resultant physical symptoms and fear it induces. The pandemic has only made anxiety worse, collectively, of course, as we struggle to get a hold on things as a culture, but individually, as more people than ever before are self-identifying with anxiety and seeking help for the first time. My guest today, Dr. Wendy Suzuki, has a great message to share in the midst of all this. She's a professor of neural science and psychology at New York University, and she's written a best-selling new book called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. In her book, Dr. Suzuki takes us through the neural mechanisms of anxiety in an understandable way, and that leads into a discussion of practices the reader can undertake to both quell, or in her words, reframe, anxiety into something positive using what she calls mindset. As a scientist, Suzuki studies the brain and its plasticity, which is the idea that we can actually remodel our brains through illness or injury, and something that we've only become aware of very recently in brain science. Her previous book is called Healthy Brain, Happy Life. Her 2018 TED Talk was the second most viewed that year. Wendy Suzuki, author of the newly released Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Wendy Suzuki, welcome to Medical Monday. Most of us, I think of the word anxiety in sort of a pejorative sense. Anxiety's bad. When is anxiety ever good?
So anxiety is good when you look at it evolutionarily, because evolutionarily, anxiety and that underlying physiological stress response that always comes with it evolved in our species to protect us. It is a protective mechanism. And the way it evolved to protect us is, you know, imagine you were a woman 2.5 million years ago gathering food, and there is a twig that cracks right nearby, and that could indicate a predator. And so our stress response system, our anxiety system kicks in. It could be a predator. Stress system kicks in that increases our heart rate and increases our respiration and shifts blood to our muscles so we can either fight or run away. So that's the fight or flight part of our nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system. And it is protective. And for all of those people out there thinking, well, my anxiety is not one little bit protective for me. The answer is because it's too high. Too much of anything, even a good thing, is not good. And all of us collectively have too much anxiety in our lives, and it's lost that protective element. So this book was written to help us bring back the goodness and the helpfulness of our anxiety, hence the title, Good Anxiety.
Yeah, and there's a bit of you're advising, I think, your readers here, and you're very clear these are not, you know, you're not saying this as a medical, this is more of a common sense approach to people who may have anxiety to some extent. And certainly we all have a little bit of anxiety. We've been living through a pandemic, you know, that has caused lots of things. What are some of the maladaptive things that anxiety can lead us to do? And you write about this in the early part of the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, maladaptive things include drinking alcohol, running for that brownie or high caloric foods, just kind of giving into the anger and angry outbursts, drugs, other kinds of drugs. All of these can be feel great at the moment, but long-term are kind of the maladaptive kinds of approaches. And then in addition to that list, I give, positive approaches to anxiety that also feel good, like deep breathing, like exercise, like meditation. And so it's about being aware of what is a good long-term strategy and what, you know, if it goes long too long, kind of like this pandemic, can be maladaptive.
Right. So what are some of those positive coping actions, as you label them, that people can do? I mean, you mentioned meditation is one, but there's quite a list here. I was wondering if you'd just share maybe a couple of others that you'd recommend, or ones that you even maybe do yourself.
The one that I like to recommend to everybody first as a number one on the list is deep breathing. Why? Because I want everybody to know that in addition to our sympathetic fight or flight part of the nervous system, Did you know you have a relaxation part of your nervous system that is kind of equal and opposite to that fight or flight system? It's called the parasympathetic nervous system, and it does everything the opposite. It decreases your heart rate, it decreases your respiration rate, and it pushes blood from your muscles towards your digestive and reproductive tract. It's also called rest and digest part of your nervous system. And so everybody should be thinking, well, how can I get more of that, you know, activated in my life? And the answer is the easiest, fastest, most direct way to activate that relaxation part of your nervous system is to breathe deeply. Breathing deeply will start to activate all these other kind of relaxation responses. And the kind of deep breathing that I recommend is a boxed breathing approach where you inhale for 4 counts, you hold it at the top for 4 counts, you exhale for 4 counts, and you hold it at the bottom for 4 counts. And I love this because you can do it and nobody even knows you're doing it. You can do it in the middle of an anxiety-provoking conversation when the other person is talking. Kids can do it standing in line to get into the classroom or sitting in their seats. It's powerful, and it is, you know, it is physiologically neuroscience based. You are activating your relaxation response with this deep breath. So that's my number one. Number two is exercise. So I spent many years studying the effects of moving your body on your brain. And the way I like to describe it is that moving, every single time you move your body, you are releasing a whole bunch of neurochemicals, growth factors, neurotransmitters in your brain. And I like to give people the image of every time you're moving, it's like you're giving your brain a bubble bath of wonderful neurochemicals, including dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline. And that is what makes you feel better. It gives you relief from anxiety and depression when you move your body. And it happens quite quickly. You can see these effects soon after you take a short walk or go up and down the stairs. And then the third approach is meditation. Even though I recognize that breath work, that box breathing, breathing is one of the oldest forms of meditation that exists. But meditation is also a wonderful way and has been shown in clinical studies to decrease anxiety levels. And for that, whatever form of meditation you like to do is the best form of meditation for you. So I recommend going to YouTube and try out all the short meditations you can find with over 1 million views. And it's a great way to sample easily and for free.
That's a really good idea about YouTube. I like that. I wanted to look at a couple of case studies that you share, and these are one example is somebody you call Liza, who sounds by all external appearances to be an incredibly successful, sort of high-powered businesswoman, and she gets into a bit of a rut. And I guess I was wondering if you could just share sort of the broad outlines of how she sort of fell from, you know, I guess high performance into a rut, and then how she combated that.
Yeah, I love this story of Liza because, you know, starts out, she is riding high. She is the kind of darling of her banking organization. She gets up, she runs first thing in the morning and she gets to work. And she also has a Peloton and she does all of that. And however, as she kind of gets senior and higher up, those coping mechanisms, which are great coping mechanisms, stop working. And she starts using other coping mechanisms like a drink just to de-stress after work. There are more issues and problems coming at her. She feels like she's not the young startup, you know, star anymore. And it all starts to weigh on her. And this is a great example because even her running started to feel like a slog and stressful to actually have to do that. And so it was a great story to illustrate the fact that it's true for so many people that sometimes coping strategies evolve and change. And even if they work before, they don't work all the time. And we always have to keep looking and exploring our coping strategies. The drinking that she was doing to de-stress, that turned into a negative coping strategy. It was disrupting her sleep, and that made her even more cranky and unable to kind of deal with her issues at work or her challenges at work. And for her, what really helped was focusing on her sleep. So getting rid of the drinking alcohol, and getting a coach, an executive coach, to ask, you know, what kinds of things can she bring to her work life and what kinds of activities that she can do to enhance that and make her feel like she is, you know, the amazing worker and executive that she really was. So I love this story because everybody has an approach that maybe they used for a long time and maybe it's not working anymore. And it's important to know that you can go back, reevaluate, try different things. And that's part of what I tried to do in Good Anxiety is give long lists of different tools that you can try. Maybe you can't figure out, well, this one didn't work. I don't know what to try. Well, go to the third part of the book and look at all the different tools there and see whether you can find another strategy that could help you for whatever form of anxiety you're dealing with.
Okay, you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Professor Wendy Suzuki, who is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at New York University, and she's the author of the best-selling new book, Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. And we're talking about anxiety. It's both its destructive and its constructive or pro-social benefits, actually, which is kind of counterintuitive here.
Yes.
And Professor Suzuki, I was wondering, one of the things that makes this book so excellent and so readable is you include yourself in the analyses. I mean, you make yourself vulnerable and talk about a time in your life when you underwent some anxiety. And there were at least a couple of instances I can remember. I mean, one, of course, was a very shocking and tragic, the death of your brother that occurred very unexpectedly, and it put you into kind of a, understandably so, into a big tailspin. Is that something you'd be willing to share some of the, you know, the emotional journey around that?
Sure. I think of that story that's in the chapter on resilience as really the foundational story for this whole book. I call it foundational because if that didn't happen, this would not be the same book. I always had the idea to write a book about anxiety, and it was called different things, Good Anxiety, Bad Anxiety. It was about making anxiety better. And we had a proposal, and I was about to jump in and write the meat of the chapters when my younger brother unexpectedly passed away of a heart attack. And it was just so unexpected and so devastating, especially because it came only 3 months after our father had passed away, also from a heart attack. But my brother was, you know, so athletic. He was the last person that you would think would have a heart attack. So I went through all of these emotions that I'd never felt before. And it was just so sad. And it was a difficult time and I couldn't write the book, but I started to recover and I started to feel better. And I was starting to realize that, boy, it changed my worldview on my family, on my relationships, how lucky we are to have each other. You know, we are, you know, not all of us passed away. It was just my brother. And so a new appreciation of not just my family, but my friends as well that rallied around and really helped me kind of come out of this. And right at this time when I was getting ready to dive back into the book on anxiety, I was doing a workout and the coach that day, it was an online workout, said, in the context of working out, you know, with great pain, you push yourself really hard in a workout, comes great wisdom. And I thought, that's what I'm experiencing, not with my workout, but with this whole experience, this great pain that my family and I went through has given me a whole new insight on appreciation of life in a brand new way. And I thought, that is the key of this book, that anxiety is not the deep grief, of course, that I went through when there's a loss in your family like that. But anxiety causes fear and uncomfortable emotions that really teach you something. And I thought, let me try and kind of wring out all of the value, all of the gifts, all of the information that comes from understanding our own anxiety. And that's how I got to the gifts or the superpowers of anxiety, is looking at anxiety through that lens, through something that was more painful than my everyday anxiety, but it's still tapping those uncomfortable feelings and what they teach us. So yeah, the book is dedicated to my father and my brother, and it would not have come out this way had those events not happened in the time course of writing this book.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry for your losses, and thank you for being so open and sharing about it. And you alluded to what you call those superpowers. And so you mentioned resilience. You know, resilience is a word I think we hear, and especially I think in the educational community, we try to teach it to our children. We talk about the values of grit and resilience. But, you know, especially during the pandemic, explain or unpack resilience for us with regard to good anxiety to the thesis of your book.
So I'm going to kind of combine two really important concepts, resilience and mindset. So I talk about these studies of stress inoculation, which I love that term, stress inoculation. Don't you want to be inoculated from stress? And these are studies that show that if you give subjects no way out of a stressful situation, they do not benefit from that stressful situation. But if there is at least one out from the stressful situation, there's a little bit more control, then you actually get better and better at dealing with these stressful situations. And I thought, well, I can't control everything, but one thing that I could go into every single stressful situation with is the mindset that this is going to teach me something. This is going to teach me something about my response, about the world, about getting through different approaches. And so it was like I was giving myself my own version of stress inoculation with this new mindset kind of shift. And I think that is the key of resilience, that, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I really believe in that approach, but it's helped if you turn in and ask, what have you learned from this? Even, you know, getting through a difficult situation. I think about it every single time I work out and I'm cursing the trainer is like, I don't want to do any more burpees, but he made me do more burpees and I didn't think I could do it. And I'm like, okay, I put a little penny in my resilience piggy bank because I got through it. I pushed through and I feel stronger because of it. So I really bring a lot of my kind of exercise, regular exercise experience to my whole concept of resilience. That part isn't in the book, but it kind of informed what I did write about in that resilience chapter. It's about how you approach these problems, is how you can really define a resilient kind of approach for whatever you're going through.
Moreover, there's this concept you write about you call flow. And I was wondering if you could just define that for us too, like reaching that state of flow, because that sounded so preferable and so such a great counterbalance to stress and anxiety.
Flow was identified and defined by a psychologist with a very difficult name, Csikszentmihalyi. Took me a long time to learn how to pronounce that. And it's a beautiful concept. The concept of flow classically is when you have practiced and achieved a level of performance that's very high, and you get flow when you are performing this well-practiced thing at a very, very high level and everything works, everything is going well. And I love this idea, but I'm also a little bit depressed by the definition, because it's like, so I only get to feel flow like maybe several seconds in my lifetime if I'm still practicing the piano and I'm not there. And also we know that states of anxiety really cut off flow. It's you cannot attain flow if you have feelings of anxiety. So, you know, what are we to do? And so I came up with this concept of a revision of classical flow that I call microflow. What is microflow? Microflow has a lot to do with the idea of savoring the moments in your life that you're doing so well, that you did something that, you know, is just lovely, even for a little moment. And I came up with this when I was in a yoga class. And, you know, I did the yoga class, was feeling really good. And then at the end, we were doing that corpse pose, Shavasana, which is just laying on the ground. And I'm like, I am flowing. I do the best laying on the ground that anybody has ever done. I am in flow. I don't care what the definition is. This is flow. And I kind of went from there. So if that's flow, then, you know, I make this amazing green smoothie for myself every morning. It's delicious. That is a moment of flow. And so I started to realize how many moments of microflow we all had. And so you think that's fine. How is that a superpower or a gift exactly for people with anxiety? And I'll tell you why. Because, as I said, anxiety cuts off flow. But the other thing that happens is that there's something called the negative contrast effect. If we have these moments of anxiety, of worry, it actually makes those lovely moments of microflow and doing the best shavasana that ever existed in the world even sweeter, because you know what those, you know, uncomfortable emotions feel like. So in a sense, your microflow is even enhanced by those other moments of anxiety. And don't get me wrong, you know, we're never going to get rid of anxiety from our lives. That is not the point of good anxiety. Good anxiety is to show you why anxiety is there, how it could be used to kind of get more comfortable with those uncomfortable feelings and wring everything you can out of that protective emotion that has developed over the last 2.5 million years.
Professor Suzuki, there's another distinction you make in the book that I think is really important, and I'd like you to educate me and our listeners on, which is sometimes depression, which is very common as well in the general population, overlaps with anxiety or coexists with anxiety. And you give case examples of that too, where somebody suffers from anxiety and is in somewhat of a rut, like you described earlier with that person that you identified as Liza. But then there's another example, and you don't have to go into Jared's case, but you point out very specifically that he's a 20-something who's kind of living at home, and he isn't really capitalizing on his college education, and he's sort of just stuck. And there's a little bit of anxiety with, like, looking for jobs, but he also, as you point out, is sort of suffering from depression as well. And so I guess if you could help us clarify and tease apart, you know, how to sort of contextualize those things, that would be really helpful.
Sure. So my simple definition of anxiety, let's start with that, is that feeling of fear or worry associated with uncertain situations. So for that particular case, it was, you know, he couldn't get a job. He couldn't find a job after college. You know, he spent 4 years thinking, okay, there's something great at the end of the rainbow and there's no job. And so, and how are we going to get a job? I don't know. That's anxiety. So depression is that affective state that just slows everything down. It stops you. It's a sadness. It's also partly fear that stops you from actively doing things. You're stuck at home, just in this very, very sad state. And there are differences in the neurochemical and the brain networks that are involved in anxiety and depression. But at the same time, many people that have one also have the other state. And so while I focused on anxiety because it was, even before the pandemic, kind of getting to such high levels that I was noticing my students and myself and my friends and my colleagues, I think some of the approaches that I talk about in good anxiety can be useful for this combo that often exists. And so I think it's worthwhile to point out what happened to Jared, who is actually an amalgamation of several case studies that I know that I talked to. This young man completely transformed and kind of got out of the situation by completely changing his environment, ending up going to Costa Rica to to teach English to school children there, and really kind of got out of that depressive environment, living in your parents' basement, you know, wanting to be on your own, but still feeling like you're an 8-year-old because you're still living with your parents, and going from that to a completely new environment where he could kind of build something new for himself, including building houses and building the schools that really got him into physical activity. And I can tell you that when one of the people that came back from this trip that I built this particular profile on, completely changed person. It was so beautiful to see. So, and it was due to everything that I talked about: physical activity, better food, more healthy diet, purpose in his life that you could just see shining on his face. So a lot of the same approaches that I talk about and the tools that I talk about for good anxiety can also work for depression. But I've really tried to focus this on this feeling and this emotion of anxiety.
Well, Professor Winnie Suzuki, I'd like to ask one more thing, which is a little bit just about the story of your career, and you highlighted in the book early in your almost just recently appointed assistant professor, I think, as you point out, and you a luminary in your field was coming to your university to speak, and you were given the task of doing the introduction. And I think we can all relate to fear of public speaking. And you get up on, you copiously research her background and her CV, and you write up this amazing, I think, 2 or 3 page introduction. And then you get to the podium, and suddenly your voice cracks and your mouth is dry. And you write very powerfully about how you remember this, and it still embarrasses you to this day, even though you're an enormously, you know, successful professor in your own right, in your own field. But I guess, could you share that story with us?
Sure. So I was a young assistant professor, just got hired, and part of my job was to be host to other professors coming in to visit the university. And this one I knew, and she was very, very prominent, and I really wanted to do a good job. And so the location where I wanted to do the best job was introducing her for her talk which is kind of silly. It's like, they don't care about the introduction. Everybody's there to see her. And yet I wanted to give this like slam dunk of a introduction. And so I spent way too much time on it. It was too long to begin with. But I started getting really nervous. Like, what if it's not good enough? What if it's not clear, as crystal clear as I wanted it to be? And to tell you the truth, she always kind of scared me. So I was also scared because of that. And so I completely flubbed it. I went up and I forgot half the things I was going to say. And I was just very, very embarrassed. So, you know, I knew that I didn't want to just give my huge successes because anxiety is about what happens to all of us when we get too anxious. And that was my most searing memory of when anxiety got to me. And it made me forget. It makes you forget. It makes you lose your words. It changes your voice. And I still remember what my voice sounded like. That is anxiety. And how is that protective? Well, I did want to do a really good job. And what I should have done is breathe a little bit more, not put so much pressure on myself. And I could have given a perfectly respectable introduction. But instead, I have a really good story for my book, Good Anxiety.
Well, in a full circle moment, you write about, I imagine, one of many graduate students who is going on to give a third year presentation and is incredibly nervous about it and has such debilitating public speaking phobia. And you coach him through it and teach him how to visualize that moment and come up with some mantras about how he's going to basically seize the day and he's going to nail it. And at least in the book, he hits a home run and he knocks it out of the park. So there are many other strategies in the book, which is Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Wendy Suzuki, who is professor of neural science and psychology at NYU. Dr. Wendy Suzuki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, John. It was a great conversation.
Dr. Wendy Suzuki is a professor of neural science and psychology at New York University. Her new book is called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.